Well, the question was, during their last thing, has anyone discussed whether the 14 or something years from now, whether there'll be a movie 7, and whether they walk back on?
You know, it's funny. I've obviously nobody knows. Yeah. I think, you know, the studio, as you know, was making them as long as people keep paying to come and see them. Because it's actually interesting. I mean, that the end story probably wouldn't be the last one to tell. Probably the first story would be the last one to tell, because it was a prequel to The Magician's Nephew. Mm. And I know that Tilda would be more than happy to come back and do that. Mm. And it would be interesting. The Last Battle would have some real challenges, obviously, if we did do it all that time. You know, our kids are going to be pretty grown up. And we definitely discussed, not very seriously, the idea of shooting all their scenes, you know, sometime in the next few years, but I don't think it's really likely to happen.
So you think they would do the creation of the world after the end of the world?
I think so. I think it kind of makes sense, really, because then it becomes a kind of like, how did all of this happen? It's like, you're telling a linear journey, and then to go back and set it up, it's somewhat even more satisfying to go back to the beginning after you finish telling the story.
The first film seemed to be a little more character-driven, and this one seemed to be more action. Driven, although there's
I hope it's character driven as well.
There is, but there's a lot more
there's
action.
A lot more action, yeah.
Now, is that going to be the trend for these films, or are you going to try to incorporate both, or what?
I mean, I think you always try and incorporate both, but really, it's I think in both cases they were driven very much by the original stories. This book was a bit more of a boy's book, and it's centered around the young prince. It's centered around battles, human on human battles, and human on creature battles. There's a lot more of that, you know. From the time Caspian escapes the castle in the book, he's then, in the structure of the book, he's actually fighting with Nereus throughout the whole time the Pippin sees him traveling. So it is just kind of centered around that. There's things that we obviously expanded out. You know, in the book, Regent Chief suggests raiding the castle, going after the cavalry. That's not something they do, but I felt like that was something that was interesting and worth expanding and sort of new imagery we hadn't seen before. But really, I think, you know, for me, it was, I just kind of tried to immerse myself in what the book was and see what came out of that in the writing process, and it just sort of evolved towards a more action driven film.
Why was Lucy's dream sequence with Aslan done as a dream sequence?
Because there's a problem, there's something you can get away with in the structure of the book where a lot of it is told in retrospect, which is the fact that Aslan is there and he doesn't do anything. But I had a problem with that cinematically, because once you show Aslan, if you don't have him do something, it's going to be like, why is he letting all this happen? I mean, it's a good question to ask. Yeah, exactly. And it became very hard to let your audience see this sort of powerful, omnipotent creature come along, hang out with the kids, and not do anything to stop this carnage. So the way that I wanted to bring Aslan to the story, I wanted to see the connection between him and Lucy. I think all those things were important in the book. And it ends up being the best way to sort of achieve that without having to explain why it happened. And then there's also that question of, was it a dream or not? You know, he repeats later on a line that he said to her in that dream. So I think that's sort of something I've deliberately left up to the audience members to interpret themselves.
On some of the other changes, you know, most of them I really enjoyed. I really enjoyed the Cassie and Susan relationship that wasn't there. One of the things I was a little bit wondering about, though, is I remember, and it's been a while since I've read this, and maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, but in the book, Susan was sort of, when she was given her gift of bow and arrow, she was told, you're not to be in battle, though, if I remember that correctly.
That
was kind of modernized.
That was in the first one, and I rejected it the first time through.
Okay, I'm wondering a little bit about that.
No, because it's terrible. It's like, well, if she's just going to make sandwiches, then give her a plate and a knife.
Right.
It's not a bow and arrow. So I think, you know, it was written in a different time, and by somebody whose views, I think, evolved. By the time he wrote Horseman's Boy, he had a very strong female character. But in the beginning of those stories, although Lucy was strong as a character, women were, you know, had to behave as girls. You know, they weren't allowed to be more assertive, and that's just something I don't agree with. So I wasn't going to actually make a movie like that. And I just think, you know, I actually had a long discussion with Doug Grisham about this as well, because, you know, when you start going away from an author's viewpoint, is it the correct thing to do? And the way I justified it to him was that I think C.S. Lewis evolved after meeting Doug's mother. And that's why in his books you see stronger female characters in the later books.
Belief versus doubt seems to be one of the major themes through it, and particularly in relation to Aslan, and he's not appearing really until the end of the movie. In the book, he seems to be introduced a little bit earlier.
Yeah.
What What was your process in kind of exploring that? Because it was really throughout the whole movie.
Yeah, I mean, in the book it sort of happens very much within one scene in the gorge when they're following us and one by one they get to see him. And I didn't want to do it that way largely because I felt like it would be a really long scene that wasn't that interesting because it's really just walking through a gorge saying, do you see him? No, do you see him? So it wouldn't play very cinematically. So really I wanted to make it sort of a belief on so many levels, belief in yourself, belief in belief and acceptance of what, you know, I guess the thing for me was within Susan there was this kind of idea of it's better of love to have loved and lost than not loved at all. And that's more with her in relation to Nani. You know, she has that line by the campfire when she says, you know, while it lasts. She said, you have to do that while it lasts. So it was kind of this, sort of going in an indirect way around your question, sorry, but it was this kind of general sense of them all coming to terms with what has happened before, who they were, who Aslan was, you know, coming to terms with their past, believing in us and believing in their past, and then sort of allowing themselves to let go and let things happen. You know, Peter's trying to control the whole thing. Susan's rejecting, accepting the thing. Lucy's really the only one that stays relatively unwavering, and in this movie, much more than the last, her self-doubt is tested as well.
In the book,
really open up all these other issues I've been talking about for a while.
Yeah. Well, Peter, obviously, he gets the force, like, hey, I'm going to do this myself. So.
Sorry, I'm trading out my hobby.
Thank you. But Peter, I mean, obviously, it's like, hey, we need to do something. We got to take care of it ourselves. Basically, just forget Adeline. So it's interesting because.
Yeah, I think, I mean, the thing for him really is also just wanting to relive his glory days. I mean, he was not, one of the things that coming out of the last film, and when I read the book initially, I went through that whole thing of like, okay, I've just been a king for 15 years, and now I have to go back and do homework. I'm not going to adjust well to that. And so for Peter, it was sort of a chance to reassert himself, to prove himself again. So he didn't really want Aslan's help, because that would mean that he needed somebody's help, and he wanted to prove that he was the High King. And therefore, he was sort of the last to come around to actually saying, okay, I need help.
In the back for a second installment in Narnia, how did you want your audience to reconnect with Narnia, even though it's been 1,300 years since the four children have come back? And what kind of challenges did that pose in your filming?
I think we've given, a huge leeway to connection just with our kids.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I found in one of the early test screenings is when the Pevensies come on, the audience were just really happy to see them. That made it easy to connect with a place that was very different. At the same time, I was actually trying to create somewhat of a disconnection, if you know what I mean. It's like the thing for me, and I related to this on a personal level, I grew up in Papua New Guinea from when I was 11 to 18, and it's a country that's gone through an awful lot of change in the last 22 years. And I've never gone back there, partly because I know that the place that I grew up doesn't really exist. There's a lot of conflict, there's curfews, there's violence. When I grew up there, I was very free. I'd jump on my motorcycle and ride off into the bush at 30 years old. So I sort of related to this sense of loss, of not being able to go back to something that you grew up with. Mm-hmm. And I realize it's also a universal thing, you can't go back to your childhood. And that's really what these kids are going through, this sort of going back to a place that no longer exists and then having to accept it and move on. And so as much as I wanted a connection, I wanted the audience to feel that sense of loss as well.
What is the theme of change? You know, the film exemplifies great change. In your estimation, what character has to make the greatest change from the beginning of the film?
It's actually a good question. I think Peter, actually. Yeah, I think because he's really going from a high king, I mean, I think the scene when he hands over his sword to Caspian is probably the biggest sign of change. I mean, he lived 15 years as this high king, conquering the giants, all those kind of things, and now he has to pass that on and accept that he's going back to being a schoolboy. That's a pretty hard change.
Yeah. Going back to the action, it wasn't exceedingly overly graphic in its violence, but it seems to be nonstop. And I'm thinking, you know, maybe 20 years ago, maybe there would have been cause to tone it back a little bit. Do you think the audiences are more accepting of that? Do you think they want more of that visceral look now?
That's a hard question, too. It's like, certainly, I mean, when you see movies like 300, the audience is exposed to a fairly fast-paced visual action on every level.
But that's adults. There could be a lot
adults.
Of kids.
No, there are kids, and obviously we were sensitive to that, and, you know, we went through with the MPAA and so on, and there were things that I took out for my own after seeing it with a younger audience, and then obviously from when the MPAA had seen it, we sort of toned back some stuff that went, okay, maybe this has gone too far. Largely for me, seeing it with kids, I mean, when you sit down and you're watching it and you're just in the headspace of making the film, you're just making it intense, you're making it exciting, you're doing all of these things because you're effectively making a film for yourself. When you start showing it to an audience, that influences then how you feel about the film. I had a similar thing on the first Shrek with some of the humor that was a little bit adult, and I started watching with children, and I was like sinking down my chair. So there were definitely some things that toned back because of that. In some cases, it's the duration of the intensity. I don't have any problem with children being scared. Let me rephrase that. I think children like to be scared. They like that intensity. They like to be on the edge of the seat. They like to be biting out as long as you let them off at some point. I think if you keep it going for too long at certain intensity, then it can become traumatizing. And it can be things as simple as sometimes letting the sound drop away and playing music. And then you get to still be in the moment, you're not taken out of it, but at the same time you don't feel abused, you don't feel beaten up by the intensity. So that's kind of the balance I was really trying to find.
Were you under instructions to make a PG movie?
Yes, we always intended to make a PG movie.
Yeah. Some of us were talking earlier about the final battle sequence in which they take the pillars out of the tunnels. Was there any sacrificial suicide going on there? Or
No, it was really just that we actually, when we started pre-vision, because I usually start working in pre-vision storyboards before I even start writing, we started pre-vision that scene, and we got to this point of, okay, here we are again, we've got a battlefield with an army on each side charging at each other. And like, we've got to do something else. I've seen this so many times. And then from that, we started talking about, well, we've got the house, so we've got this underground, what can we do with an underground? And from there came the idea, well, what if the whole battlefield was suspended on a parking lot, effectively, in like an underground system? And then what could we do? And that sort of just evolved from that point of like, how can we find something new and interesting and different? And then that's sort of just what it evolved into. So no deeper meaning than that, I'm afraid to say, just what it's called.
Humor seemed to be a big aspect in this film. I think that probably relates to some of the intensity. Talk a little bit about that. I guess Reed Pachib and the kids' interaction, there just seemed to be a lot more attempt at humor.
It's an attempt, thank you. I don't know that it was as thought out. It is. I was actually really pleased the first time I saw it with an audience at how much they laughed. And they laughed at things I didn't even think were that funny, which is a good sign, because part of it was just sort of love of the characters. Again, it just sort of evolved that way. I think there was more opportunity within the book. I mean, Reed Pachib is a great character in the book. And in Dawn Treader, he's even better. He's expanded further. He's a character, I think, that subconsciously I based Puss in Boots pretty heavily on. So immediately, if you put Eddie Izzard in a mouse, and you know whatever he says is going to be funny. Truffle Hunter, I think, is, you know, just a very charming character, and you get a lot of sort of humor just from how sincere he is. I like humor. I mean, obviously, I've worked on some funny films before. I enjoy humor. I enjoy, you know, taking the audience to place attention and then letting them off with humor. I enjoy the fact that humor can undercut things that seem over sincere or saccharine. So I guess I just kind of try and inject it where it's appropriate and where it can kind of come from the character.
Last question.
How involved are you on the third film?
In the last couple of months, not very involved. But no, pretty involved. I mean, I've been working with them in terms of getting the script together and so on. I've obviously, in the last month or two, withdrawn a little bit from that to finish this film, and then we'll be getting back into it pretty soon.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.